Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Default, the landmark court battle over Argentina's $100 billion debt restructuring. By Gregory Makoff. Foreword by Lee C. Buckhite. Narrated by Timothy Andres Pabon. Publisher's note: short reference PDFs, including the book's featured characters, a timeline of events, and a glossary of terms, may be downloaded from press.georgetown.edu/book/default. The idea in life is to try to be a judge, never a partisan. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, Twitter, April 25th, 2023. Forward. The facts of life are this: we do not have a normal situation. Judge Thomas P. Grise, February 23, 2012. Even a decade later, it is hard to discern whether Judge Thomas P. Grise ever fully realized that he was presiding over a protracted Kobayashi Maru scenario. Judge Grise, the senior U.S. Federal District Court judge, before whom all lawsuits involving Argentina's defaulted bonds were consolidated, believed in his soul that court judgments, particularly his judgments, should be paid or settled by the defendant. When the Republic of Argentina openly defied those judgments for more than a decade, the U.S. federal judiciary branded the country a uniquely recalcitrant debtor. But what appeared as willful defiance to U.S. judges was, in the view of Argentine authorities, the only rational policy that could be followed. The country had experienced a devastating economic crisis starting in 2001. That crisis forced a default on nearly $100 billion of Republic of Argentina bonds. Every one of those instruments was a legal, valid, and binding obligation under New York law, enforceable in a New York court at the absolute discretion of the holder. Every single holder was thus, from a legal perspective, armed and dangerous. Like all sovereign debtors, however, Argentina lacked a bankruptcy-style mechanism to force any of those bondholders to accept an offer to restructure the securities. Sovereign borrowers in this situation have only one effective weapon to induce holdout creditor participation in a workout: the threat that any who decline to join the restructuring will be consigned to the outer darkness of perpetual payment default. Most sovereign debtors in this situation convey that message with at least a modicum of subtlety. Argentina elected to deliver the message brutally, repeatedly, and inflexibly, a tactical decision that later turned out to be the country's undoing. For obvious reasons, no sovereign debtor can offer its creditors a choice between accepting a debt restructuring in which, by definition, they will lose money, or obtaining a court judgment on their claims that will be paid in full, or at the worst, settled on terms better than those offered in the restructuring. Such an offer would inevitably result in the entirety of the country's creditors electing to become judgment creditors. Nothing would be resolved. The Argentine authorities therefore felt that they had no choice other than obstinately to defy Judge Grise's orders, and Grise felt that he had no choice other than to insist that Argentina pay or settle his judgments. The result? A no-win, no escape, no alternative standoff. In the entire history of sovereign debt workouts and sovereign debt disputes, there has never been anything like the events Gregory Makoff recounts in this book. He takes us into the negotiating rooms, the back rooms, the courtrooms, and the settlement rooms where this 15-year struggle agonizingly unfolded. The main dramatis personae in this story, Argentina, the holdout creditors, and Judge Grise, were all convinced that they had both the moral and legal right to behave in the way they did. Indeed, each felt that they were duty-bound to behave in no other way. Some listeners of this book may conclude that we shall not have peace in the sovereign debt markets until the last avaricious hedge fund manager is strangled in the entrails of the last boastful debtor country politician. Perhaps. But largely as a result of the events described in this book, the sovereign debt community has focused most of its intellectual energies over the last 20 years on finding mechanisms that will prevent maverick creditors from using the courts to extract preferential recoveries from financially distressed sovereign debtors, recoveries made possible only by the willingness of their fellow creditors to provide debt relief to the afflicted country. Contractual provisions, collective action clauses, that bind dissident lenders to the restructuring decisions of the supermajority of their colleagues, have since 2003 become widespread in sovereign bonds governed by New York law. A variety of other proposals, including possible changes in law to facilitate sovereign debt restructurings, are also being debated. The hope is that one or more of these mechanisms will save sovereign debtors from being forced into a situation in which they must either accept preferential settlements with their more litigious creditors or incur the judicial moniker of uniquely recalcitrant. Lisi Buckhite, Millbrook, New York, November 2022. Introduction. On the evening of November 26, 2001, Anne Krueger stepped up to the microphone at the annual dinner of the National Economists Club and spoke about a festering problem in the area of sovereign debt restructuring. Already a distinguished academic and policymaker, as first deputy managing director, Krueger was the top-ranked American at the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and second in command after the managing director, a role by tradition given to a European. As such, her words came with added authority. The title of her speech was A New Approach to Sovereign Debt Restructuring, and it was timely because everyone in the audience knew that Argentina was teetering on the brink of a $100 billion default. Krueger got straight down to business. In her fabulously clear speaking voice, she boomed that there's a gaping hole in the international financial architecture for resolving sovereign debt crises. She said, "We lack incentives to help countries with unsustainable debts resolve them promptly and in an orderly way. At present, the only available mechanism requires the international community to bail out the private creditors. It is high time this hole was filled." Krueger's essential observation was that while households and corporations around the world benefit from bankruptcy laws to shield them from creditors when insolvent, countries lack access to this basic protection. If it strikes you as odd that it was an economist, not a lawyer, giving a keynote speech on the topic of bankruptcy, here's why nobody in the audience batted an eye. From the 1980s, the IMF had been an important player in virtually all sovereign debt restructurings around the world, a role stemming from its business of lending to and advising countries in distress. What did capture their attention that night was what Krueger had to say. She was proposing that the IMF would not just have an important role in future sovereign debt restructurings, but instead that it would run the show. Krueger's idea was for the IMF to set up a new international facility, what she called a sovereign debt restructuring mechanism, SDRM, to administer future sovereign debt restructurings, and under which the IMF would gain extraordinary new legal powers, including the authority to decide when countries could default and enjoy protection from litigation while they worked out their debts. The world urgently needed an SDRM, Kruger explained, because countries had changed how they borrowed from the market over the prior decade. In the 1970s, developing countries took out large loans from major international banks such as Citibank and Chase Manhattan. After a wave of defaults in the 1980s, banks stopped lending to sovereigns. So developing countries went to the international bond market for all their new borrowings. By the end of the 1990s, most sovereign debt was in bond format. This shift created a problem. In the past, a financially troubled country would sit down with a dozen or so of its leading banks and negotiate a workable repayment schedule. Now that sovereign debt was owned by thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of bond investors spread out all over the world, that was no longer possible. The problem, Kruger observed, was that private creditors had become increasingly numerous, anonymous, and difficult to coordinate. In addition to its coordination problem, sovereign debt restructuring had a legal problem as well, Kruger said. She pointed out that just the year before, a Belgian court had forced Peru to repay one investor in full, even though the country's other lenders had all voluntarily accepted a significant loss. Kruger called out the name of the investor who'd won special treatment through litigation, a vulture company called Elliott Associates. Yet Kruger's new idea would do nothing for Argentina's exposure to these two problems. She admitted in her speech that her SDRM idea would take a few years to implement and therefore could not be used to resolve Argentina's rapidly deteriorating situation. Just 10 days later, on December 6, 2001, the IMF pulled the plug on Argentina, which led, over the following 4 weeks, to the freezing of the country's financial system, the fall of the government, a steep devaluation of Argentina's currency, and default on about $100 billion of bonds. Thus began a 15-year chain of events that proved Kruger right. There was a gaping hole in the system of restructuring sovereign debt, and just as she had warned, when Argentina moved to restructure its debt, it was beset by problems coordinating its many creditors and was hit by a massive wave of litigation. To top it off, the litigation was led by the same hedge fund Kruger had flagged in her speech, Elliott Associates. The story. This book follows Argentina as it fought a 15-year battle to restructure its debt after its default on about $100 billion of bonds in December 2001. It is a disaster story with multiple problems besieging the restructuring, some stemming from inadequacies of law and contract, some political, and some that were homegrown. Without a doubt, what Argentina went through was worse than any worst-case scenario that any audience member could have imagined when listening to Ann Kruger's speech on November 26, 2001. The first third of the book covers the period from Argentina's 2001 default through June 2005, when it restructured 76% of its defaulted debt. Chapter 1 features bitter fights between Argentina and the IMF over the terms of a new lending program during 2002. Covering the period of 2003 through 2005, Chapters 2 and 3 detail Argentina's bond restructuring process and feature a three-way battle between Argentina, the IMF, and creditor activists about how the negotiations should be handled. Argentina's deal was marketed without the support of the IMF and under attack from creditor activists, so the country's transaction was not entirely successful. Holders of $19.6 billion of bonds rejected the deal, opting instead to sue, and setting the stage for the latter two-thirds of the story. Chapter 4 details Elliot's lawsuits against Peru between 1996 and 2000, the same litigation Ann Kruger flagged in her 2001 speech. Although a break in the chronology, this detailed analysis of the earlier litigation is essential background for understanding the Argentina cases, particularly in terms of how Elliot used the pari passu clause in Peru's loans to convince a Belgian court to rule in its favor in September 2000. The chronology also provides a convenient way to introduce Elliot's sovereign debt investment team and the firm's business model. Chapters 5 and 6 dive into the almost 300 lawsuits that holdout investors brought against Argentina and the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, the Southern District. These chapters feature dozens of assorted plaintiffs making ad hoc, uncoordinated efforts to attach Argentina's assets via court order. They went after bank accounts, bond holdings, diplomatic properties, a presidential plane, satellite parts, and a ship carrying a cargo of liquefied natural gas on the high seas. Yet with two small exceptions, these efforts failed, it being nearly impossible to collect from a defaulting sovereign. Frustrated by the lack of recovery through litigation, two-thirds of Argentina's holdouts capitulated and accepted Argentina's reopening of its offer in 2010, even though the terms were no better than the country's prior offer. Their participation brought Argentina's aggregate success rate in restructuring its defaulted debt to 92%. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 cover the litigation the holders of the remaining 8% of defaulted debt continued to bring. Elliot brought its long-anticipated pari passu claim against Argentina in October 2010. The matter came to a head at a February 2012 hearing when the hedge fund's lawyer, former Solicitor General Theodore Olson, argued to Judge Thomas P. Grise that the judge should use his judicial power to compel Argentina to pay Elliot and its co-plaintiffs in full by blocking payments to the 92% of bondholders who had settled with the country in 2005 and 2010. Despite pleas from debt restructuring experts to not favor the holdouts, Judge Grise imposed the injunction, which gave Argentina two choices: pay Elliot in full and be permitted to pay all its other bondholders, or refuse to pay Elliot and be forced into default because the court would block payments to the other creditors. Pausing the pari passu story, Chapter 9 provides an overview of litigation taking place in other states and around the world, including Elliot's attachment of Argentina's tall ship ARA Libertad in Ghana in 2012. The chapter also covers economic and political developments in Argentina after 2010, as well as Elliot's intensive lobbying efforts in Washington and elsewhere. Returning to the pari passu story, Chapter 10 discusses Argentina's decision in July 2014 to default rather than pay Elliot, which leads to even more bitter litigation. However, just weeks after Argentina's 2014 default, the sovereign debt market accepts powerful new clauses in their bonds to prevent holdouts from profiting at their expense in the future. Chapter 11 brings the story to a close with a play-by-play description of the settlement that Argentina and its holdout investors reached in early 2016, following the election of Mauricio Macri as the president of Argentina in November 2015. President Macri makes settling the country's legal dispute with the holdouts the first priority of his new government, and his team inks a surprisingly good deal by persuading the court-appointed arbitrator, Special Master Daniel Pollack, to help the country turn the tables on Elliot. Approach. All the events described earlier are fairly well known to regular readers of the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, or the business section of the New York Times over the last 20 years. What is less known are the root causes, the reasons, the answer to the question of why. Why did these events occur? How are the people, institutions, and ideas interconnected? Why was Argentina's 2005 debt restructuring so contentious? And most important of all, why did Judge Grisey make his famous, some would say infamous, decision to impose the injunction on Argentina in 2012? These are the questions this book strives to answer, while at the same time teaching listeners how the world of sovereign debt restructuring really works. To answer these questions, I take listeners into the room as the events play out, telling the story almost as a historical drama. I allow the characters to speak for themselves as much as possible, relying heavily on verbatim quotes taken from primary sources, such as court transcripts and IMF Executive Board meeting minutes. I took this approach to make the book more fun to listen to, and to make the topic of sovereign debt restructuring accessible to a broader audience. But this approach also yields a more authentic product, as each event was truly the consequence of choices made by human beings, governments, and institutions, some wise and some less so. However, scholars may note there are sources backing every claim the book makes, including legal citations in the level of detail and in the format conventionally found in law review articles. One challenge with Argentina's story is that it involves many characters, institutions, and events. To help listeners keep track, I repeat the year of the action and the full title and affiliations of characters in every chapter subsection, except where it would be excessively repetitive. Now, on to Argentina's default. 1. Argentina defaults and then fights with the IMF. December 2001 through March 2003. On December 6, 2001, the IMF pulled the plug, announcing that it was refusing to disburse a pending $1.24 billion loan installment to Argentina. The reason? The IMF had determined that Argentina's finances were unsustainable. This withdrawal of official support pushed Argentina, which had already been teetering on the brink, over the edge. Within weeks, in response to draconian measures to stabilize the country's banking system in the absence of IMF support, Argentines filled the streets screaming, "They should all go." Argentina's Minister of Economy resigned, and on December 20th, President Fernando de la Rúa dramatically fled, departing from the roof of the presidential palace via helicopter. Default followed on December 23rd, when Adolfo Rodríguez Saá, one of the country's three interim presidents that month, announced a moratorium on the repayment of the country's external debt to the Argentine Congress. Lawmakers rose to their feet and cheered, "Argentina! Argentina!" If at the time of the default the country's economy was in a deep freeze, reminiscent of the darkest days of the Great Depression in the United States, in the new year, the situation worsened. Argentina suffered from a sharp drop in economic activity, recurrent banking holidays, and sky-high unemployment. The social dimension of the crisis was enormous. Over half the Argentine population slipped below the poverty line. Crime was way up. Rioting and lawlessness ruled the streets. Those in the middle class experienced social disorder that left them shocked and disoriented. There were pickets everywhere, massive and multi-sectorial strikes, and no-notice raids on local supermarkets, with crowds coming out of nowhere to strip the shelves bare. An important trigger of this disorder was a breakdown of the payment system. To deal with the lack of foreign currency liquidity after the withdrawal of IMF support, the government cut access to bank accounts, which meant that middle-class families could not withdraw enough money to meet regular expenses, and there was no money to pay workers in the cash economy. The result was lines of angry depositors at banks, and lines of poor people at city halls looking for handouts so they could feed their families. In a spontaneous mid-December eruption, people all over Argentina started banging pots and pans in anger, a subsequently regular form of mass protest the press called cacerolazos. And late at night, Buenos Aires, the country's beautiful capital, came to be haunted by an army of 30,000 cartoneros, poor men, women, and children, who collected discarded boxes just to earn enough money to buy maybe a pizza. All this was happening in a country that had long enjoyed a relatively high standard of living. Washington policymakers did not pull the plug on Argentina without a lot of thought. They knew that ordinary Argentines would suffer, and they knew that bondholders would experience deep losses. All that said, Argentina's economy was broken beyond repair. For a decade, the country had relied on its convertibility plan, which featured a one-for-one peg of the peso to the U.S. dollar, a scheme adopted to bring an end to the hyperinflation of the 1980s. The one-for-one peg tamed inflation, but created other problems over time, including an unsustainable buildup of external debt by the government and the private sector. After all, dollar-based debt appeared much cheaper to service than its peso-based equivalent. Investors demanded a lower coupon for dollar bonds, since they would be protected if Argentina's one-for-one peg broke someday. Unfortunately, Argentina's pegged currency regime also made the country vulnerable to external shocks, including global credit market volatility and competitive currency devaluations by its neighbors. Argentina was hit hard by a series of such events in the late 1990s, including the Asian financial crisis, Russia's August 1998 default, and in January 1999, the steep devaluation of the Brazilian real. Data show that Argentina's economy never recovered from these shocks, with the country falling into a multi-year recession, which led to shrinking revenues, rising expenditures, increasing government debt, extraordinarily high unemployment, and extreme political polarization. The IMF's judgment in December 2001 was that lending more to Argentina would only make matters worse. It was time to let the country fail. The IMF does not speak so directly about countries in harm's way, however. What IMF chief economist Kenneth Rogoff did say that month was, "It's clear that the mix of fiscal policy, debt, and exchange rate regime is not sustainable," which in plain English meant there would be no more money from Washington until Argentina started dealing with its debt overhang and fixed exchange rate. No more bailouts. There was more than math at work in the decision to let Argentina fail. There was also an idea. George W. Bush's administration firmly believed that it was time to stop bailing out troubled countries, even if this led to bond defaults. This was a relatively new idea, but one that had picked up steam in the second half of the 1990s. Conservatives, led by Carnegie Mellon professor Alan Meltzer, bemoaned the $10 billion-plus rescue packages that Mexico, Thailand, Indonesia, South Korea, and Russia had received during the Clinton administration. They believed that bailouts created a moral hazard. They believed that when investors lent to countries with lax economic controls, those governments were incentivized to start making risky economic decisions under the expectation that they would get an IMF bailout if their bets didn't work out as expected. This prospect irked conservatives. They didn't want U.S. taxpayer money to be handed over to foreign governments and bondholders who had made bad choices. It was time, they said, to start letting countries fail, to teach them and their lenders a lesson. Argentina's bad luck.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?